This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
On this channel, we have often talked about a certain kind of thinker or figure in history. We try to keep it diverse, of course, but there's no denying that there's been a certain tendency in my choice of subjects for episodes. There's been a lot of Sufis, a lot of philosophers and people like that, and sometimes also a lot of figures who are a bit less known, perhaps, or that whose ideas may surprise a lot of you. Today, we're going to do something a little different. Ibn Taymiyyah is a significant yet very divisive figure in Islamic history, but definitely one who has shaped the Islamic world to a large degree. Maybe not so much in his own lifetime or in the period following, but definitely today. Indeed, the ideas and thought of Ibn Taymiyyah is one of the main inspirations between some of the more contemporary and modern movements within Islam, like the so-called Wahhabis and Salafis. Thus, Ibn Taymiyyah can rightly be considered one of the main architects of the modern Islamic world. But who was he, and what were these ideas that made him, well, both so divisive and controversial, but also so loved by many others? Taqi ad-Din Ahmad ibn Taymiyyah was a jurist and theologian in the 13th and 14th centuries who has become famous for his unique approach to Islamic law, as well as his staunch criticism of anything that he considered to be bid'ah, or innovation in the religion. This including things like Shi'ism, many aspects of Sufism, as well as other ideas and practices held by fellow Muslims at the time. He was born in the city of Harran in modern Turkey, but spent most of his life in Damascus, Syria. His year of birth, 1263, gives us an indication of the social and political circumstances of the time. This was right after the Mongols had sacked the city of Baghdad, executed the last Abbasid caliph, and thus had shockingly and violently destroyed the main symbol of Islamic authority and civilization, a civilization that previously had once stood as seemingly the greatest in the world. Needless to say, this was a truly shocking turn of events, and Ibn Taymiyyah is born and lives in this very tumultuous and uncertain time, something that not only occupied him greatly in his career, but which I think is also central to understanding where many of his ideas come from. He came from a family line of Hanbali scholars and would also attach himself to this school and become a rather prominent representative. Now, Sunni Islamic law is usually divided into four primary schools: the Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali. The last, the Hanbali school, is the smallest in terms of adherents and is usually considered the most quote-unquote strict. There's a lot more to it than a simple categorization like that, of course, but that is how it is usually characterized. And Ibn Taymiyyah would become quite a prominent Hanbali jurist and scholar in Damascus during his lifetime, even if he did diverge from it at times. He earned himself a reputation early on as a very charismatic and passionate individual, and is described by chroniclers as everything from deeply pious and heroic to even rude and argumentative. He began writing juristic works from a Hanbali position early on, and passionately engaged himself with public disputes and matters of religion and law. In one story, after a Christian is claimed to have insulted the Prophet Muhammad, Ibn Taymiyyah very forcefully argued that he should be executed regardless if he repented and even if he became a Muslim, a point that many other jurists disagreed on. But some of his most major legal and political engagement relate to the very dramatic Mongol invasions that were still very much underway. Ibn Taymiyyah lived in Damascus, which was mostly ruled by the Mamluks with their base in Cairo, Egypt. The Mamluks are famous for basically being the only Islamic polity that was able to withstand the Mongols at the time, as the Mongols never actually made it into North Africa. But during Ibn Taymiyyah's life, Damascus and Syria saw repeated attempts by the Mongols to invade, and some of which were successful. So he's living in a place that is constantly at war or under threat of war, and the Mongols would occupy a lot of his legal writing and energy. In fact, Ibn Taymiyyah wrote 3 fatwas, or legal rulings, that called for jihad in the form of holy war or armed struggle against the invading Mongols. In these, he argues for the fact that even though the Mongols may claim to be Muslims, they fail to uphold Islamic ideals and should therefore be fought. He even participated in the fighting as a soldier himself on the Mamluk side, whom he often praised as the true defenders of Islam. Indeed, these fatwas have become quite influential today, particularly the 3rd one, which is the longest and most harsh, and which argues, among other things, that because the Mongols did not uphold Islamic law, as he saw it, they could be considered apostates or unbelievers and should therefore be killed. This way of justifying armed jihad by deeming others apostates or unbelievers, known as takfir, is one of the main ideological tools of violent jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda or the so-called Islamic State, and they often use the fatwas of Ibn Taymiyyah in particular as inspiration. Similar harshness can be seen in fatwas issued by Ibn Taymiyyah against the so-called Nusayris, often referred to today as the Alawis or Alawites, as well as the Druze. About the latter, the Druze, he says, quote, "They are heretics and apostates whose repentance cannot be accepted. Rather, they should be killed wherever they are found, and they may be cursed because of what they are." His writings against the Nusayris follow a very similar line. These writings of his may appear very harsh, and they were harsh. They were unusually harsh for the time, and Ibn Taymiyyah actually became quite controversial during his life because he seemed to diverge from the mainstream or quote-unquote orthodox positions of other Islamic scholars. Both his views on Islamic law as well as his theological views and his many critiques of the Sufis would earn him a lot of enemies, and in fact Ibn Taymiyyah was imprisoned multiple occasions during his life. Once in 1306, after being accused of tajzim, or corporealism or anthropomorphism, basically claiming that God has human attributes. Another time, voluntarily in 1308. A third time in 1320 for teaching unorthodox things about divorce oaths. And a final time in 1326 because he and his students criticized the very common Sufi practice of visiting the graves of saints. And it is during this last prison stay in the citadel of Damascus that Ibn Taymiyyah passed away in 1328 at the age of 65. He had spent a long life in passionate defense of what he considered to be a correct understanding of Islam and gathered a relatively small but significant group of followers. Perhaps most famously, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, who would carry his ideas forward arguably in an even more forceful way and become a famous and important figure in his own right. Ibn Taymiyyah was not only active as a public figure and critic, for example, teaching in the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus and being very active and vocal in various social and religious/political issues, he was also quite a prolific writer. Now, he didn't produce any sort of major career-defining works like many of his contemporaries did. Instead, the written works of Ibn Taymiyyah are plentiful, but they are usually shorter treatises and often dedicated to very specific topics, often as a kind of conversation or debate with other people. So he's often responding or criticizing other scholars or specific ideas that other scholars have, as well as writing specific works that criticizes specific things within the Islamic world at the time that he considered to be problematic, like Kalam theology, certain aspects of Islamic law, and certain Sufi practices. Let's dedicate ourselves a little bit to understanding these works and the general positions and ideas of Ibn Taymiyyah. First, I think it's very beneficial to get a grasp of the context in which these ideas emerged. As I mentioned in the beginning, this was a traumatic time for the Muslim community where he lived. Not only was this an environment of almost constant war and invasion, but they had just experienced the fall of Baghdad and the Abbasid Caliphate, the greatest symbol of Islamic political rule. This must have been an almost cataclysmic event to many at the time, including Ibn Taymiyyah. How in the world could seemingly some nomads from the steppes of Mongolia manage to basically decimate a major part of the Islamic world, perhaps one of the greatest civilizations that the world had ever seen? And in such a short time, too. This was the question that occupied Ibn Taymiyyah's mind and which I think informs his whole worldview. He has an answer to this question. The reason that this has happened is because the Muslims have gone astray. They have left the ways of the Prophet behind and instead indulge in innovation and un-Islamic practices. In a way then, the Mongol invasions is like a punishment from God because the Muslims have failed to uphold the law and the principles of the Quran and the example of the Prophet Muhammad. With this in mind, we can see why Ibn Taymiyyah's ideas appear so harsh and seemingly unforgiving. From his point of view, something was seriously wrong and needed to be changed right away, or the rest of the Islamic world could face the same destruction. And this is really what his whole career, including his writings, is about. He is constantly and very forcefully arguing against any form of bid'ah, or innovation in the religion, including some of the most established structures of the tradition of Islamic law, and instead urging people to return back to the pure practices and ideas of the pious predecessors, the Salaf as-Saleh, in other words, the companions of the Prophet Muhammad and the two succeeding generations, or at least his understanding of what these predecessors believed and practiced. So what was it exactly that he criticized? Well, a major target for his critique were the Sufis. They were highly responsible for introducing various innovations to the religion according to Ibn Taymiyyah. Now, contrary to popular belief, Ibn Taymiyyah wasn't necessarily against Sufism per se or entirely. He claims on several occasions that there is room for Sufism within Islam, but a Sufism that is primarily ethical and aligned with his interpretation of Islamic law. He argues that certain early Sufis like Junayd of Baghdad and Abd al-Qadir al-Jilani kept within the bounds of the law and were thus acceptable. He wrote scathing critiques of Sufi practices like dhikr, the repetitious chanting of God's names. A whole treatise was dedicated to criticizing the practice of sama, the spiritual audition where one listens to music as a spiritual practice, as well as other common concepts like fana, or annihilation, where the mystic experiences a death of the self and absorption into the divine. Perhaps most controversially, he was highly critical of the common practice of visiting the graves of saints. This has been an incredibly widespread practice in Muslim history and often associated with Sufism. It is thought that the tomb or shrine of a dead Sufi saint or prophet contains their baraka, or blessings, and that one can partake in this blessing by visiting their graves. Many even ask for favors or help in things in life, thus letting the saint act as an intercessory figure that could increase the likelihood of God helping you, to put it very simply. Ibn Taymiyyah and his followers were totally against this. He feared that this was far too close to polytheism or idolatry and forbade it. There are no places that are inherently sacred, according to Ibn Taymiyyah, and help can only be asked from God directly, thus rejects the whole idea of intercession. He writes, quote, "I and others used to follow the doctrine of the fathers in visiting graves. We used to uphold the views of the innovators. When it became clear to us what the messenger had brought, we had to decide whether to follow what God had revealed or to follow what we had found our fathers doing. it was obligatory to follow the messenger. This position that he and his followers took was very controversial at the time. Sufism, at this point, was basically the mainstream form of Islam, and by forbidding by having this opinion about the visiting of graves, Ibn Taymiyyah seemed to undermine the entire power and authority of the different saints. Ibn Taymiyyah basically forbade any form of pilgrimage to one of these graves or shrines, or any travel really, with the express purpose of making one of these visits, even if it was to the grave of the Prophet Muhammad in Medina himself. Now, he wasn't completely unforgiving. He did allow people to visit the shrines or graves of prophets or certain saints if one was traveling to some location for another purpose, just basically stopping by the grave, that was okay, as long as one didn't ask for favors from the saint or the prophet, just simply appreciating their life and remembering them and praying perhaps, but basically taking away all the barakah, the grace, and all these other aspects that were so central to grave visits at the time. As we saw earlier, Ibn Taymiyyah's condemnation of this practice was one of the reasons that he was imprisoned, actually. It was that important of a practice in the Islamic world at the time. And we can see remnants of this view today in groups that are inspired by Ibn Taymiyyah, such as the so-called Wahhabis, for example. When they took over the cities of Mecca and Medina in the 20th century, they basically demolished the graves and shrines of many of the Prophet's family members and companions because of this ideological reason. We also see many violent jihadist groups today demolish shrines of different Sufi saints, for example, and this all stems back to the critiques of Ibn Taymiyyah. Many Sufi-affiliated Muslims at the time were outraged by his many criticisms, especially after he began attacking the very popular Muhyiddin ibn al-Arabi and his major doctrines. The school of this major mystic, the main idea of which has become known as Wahdat al-Wujud, or the unity of being, was very popular at the time, and when Ibn Taymiyyah started basically calling them heretics by accusing them of pantheism or of stating that God and creation is one and the same thing, he made a lot of enemies. In a famous account, the significant early leader of the Shadhili Sufi order, Ibn Ata'illah, is said to have led a group of 500 Sufis to protest against Ibn Taymiyyah, and the two are also said to have had a formal debate. It seems that it was the fact that he angered many of the Sufis so much, who themselves had such a high standing in society, that led to his imprisonment. All of these views stems from Ibn Taymiyyah's strict view of Islamic law and his constant insistence on avoiding all forms of innovation. And this strict view of innovation was quite unique at the time. In his own writings, he claims, quote, "The word law in the custom of the people has taken on three meanings: the revealed law, the interpreted law, and the adulterated law. The revealed law is the book and the sunnah established by the messenger. Following this law is obligatory for both the earlier and the later generations of Muslims. The interpreted law is the rulings in which the scholars exercise independent reasoning, or ijtihad. It is permissible to follow the authority of a founder among the founders of the four Sunni law schools. And lastly, the adulterated law includes the fabricated hadiths, wrong-headed interpretations, and misguiding innovations that have been introduced into the law but do not belong to it." To Ibn Taymiyyah, all forms of innovations are wrong and belong to the category of adulterated law. If a certain idea or practice was not observed by the Prophet or his companions, the Salaf, then they had no place in Islam. This was not the mainstream position at the time. Of course, one was very careful about introducing innovations into the religion, but many innovations were seen as good innovations and accepted on that basis. They would often point to innovations introduced after the Prophet's death. Certain new prayers were introduced by the early caliphs. That was a good innovation. The Quran was compiled into a physical book after the Prophet's death, so that was also an innovation, but a good one. Sufis would perhaps argue that dhikr in certain forms was an innovation, but a good one that brings the practitioner closer to God. But Ibn Taymiyyah strongly disagrees. All forms of innovation are bad, and there is no going around it. And this was his basis for condemning many of the practices of the Sufis, as well as many mainstream theological ideas, as we will see. But this rather unique position meant that he had a very different approach to Islamic law than most Muslims at the time. During his life, Sunni Islamic law had since long developed into the four primary schools, the Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali, to which he belonged. And in general, the approach to law was that of taqlid, or imitation, of following already established legal precedents. For example, a Shafi'i had a long tradition of previous juridical argument that he could draw from and make judgments. And usually he didn't have to actively go back to the original sources and interpret them again to arrive at a conclusion. That job had already been done by his predecessors in his legal school. Now, while Ibn Taymiyyah did technically belong to the Hanbali school, he also shows clear signs of being critical of the whole system. He rejects the reliance on taqlid, or imitation, and instead puts a heavy emphasis on ijtihad, or independent interpretation. Not necessarily based on one's rational deductions, but on going back directly to the Quran and the Sunnah and finding the answers directly there. He believed that these texts had all the answers and that the pure Islam of Muhammad and the Salaf could be found there by reading them directly and not by slavishly following one of the established law schools. Now, since no human being can escape his own interpretive framework, Ibn Taymiyyah ends up usually interpreting these sources from a Hanbali perspective nonetheless, but not always. There are instances where he diverges from it and sometimes even holds opinions that none of the law schools seem to, like in the famous case about divorce oaths. In any case, this is the basic approach to law that Ibn Taymiyyah has, as well as basically the fundamental core of Salafism, which has become so prominent today. It is a rejection of tradition and instead the belief that one can find the more pure and original version of the religion by going back and reading the original sources. Indeed, this rather unique approach has inspired many of the more modernist and contemporary movements within Islam, as we will see later. But this also informed other aspects of Ibn Taymiyyah's thought as well, for example, his theological ideas. Now, to Ibn Taymiyyah, theology actually was part of the more wider category of Islamic law, and so the approach that he has to the Sharia, the Islamic law, is essentially the same that he has to the theology of the religion. As we saw in his biography, he was continuously accused of corporealism or anthropomorphism, and even actually imprisoned because of it. But where does this come from? Well, just as he was very critical of the Sufis and some of their practices, so he was also critical of what he saw as doctrinal innovations in the form of kalam theology and philosophy. Kalam is a word that denotes a kind of philosophical theology. It is a tradition of speculative and systematic theology that had become very popular. The most widespread school of kalam in the Sunni world, the Ash'ari school, founded by Abul Hasan al-Ash'ari, represented both then and for most of history the mainstream theological position in Sunni Islam, and was at the time of Ibn Taymiyyah primarily represented by the great scholar and theologian Fakhreddin al-Razi. This kind of theology, inspired by philosophical speculation and of great philosophers like Ibn Sina, was also a form of innovation to Ibn Taymiyyah and went against Quranic descriptions of God. In the Kalam schools, including the Ash'ariya, many verses in the scriptures, the Quran, were read symbolically, and one was very adamant to have God be completely beyond any creaturely qualities. God is totally incorporeal, he is formless, he's outside of time and space, neither in the world nor outside it, and it's ultimately beyond description. So any descriptions in the Quran that seem to apply human attributes to God were read metaphorically by the Kalam theologians. When the Quran says that God has a hand, it means that he has power, for example, not a literal hand. Ibn Taymiyyah responds to this approach in critical terms. In his theological works such as the Wasitiya, the Hamawiya, the Bayan al-Talbis al-Jahmiya, and the 11-volume-long Dar'a Ta'rud, Averting the Conflict, he attacks theologians like Ar-Razi and instead presents his own perspectives on theology. These works and ideas would become central to the theological positions of groups like the Salafis and the so-called Wahhabis today. Now again, Ibn Taymiyyah belonged to the Hanbali school, who had generally rejected Kalam and instead followed their own theological inclinations. Famously, they rejected the symbolic reading of Quranic verses, instead opting to take God's word for what it is and trust in the word used in the text. That doesn't mean that they had a completely anthropomorphic view of God, though. Rather than accepting outright that God has a hand, for example, they argue that one should accept what the text says, but not inquire further about what it means. If the text says that God has a hand, then we take that at face value, but we don't ask what it means. This is an idea that has often been known as bila kayf, literally meaning without how, or without asking how, sometimes also without modality. Some would argue that this still counts as anthropomorphism, but it's still a bit more complicated than that. It's a kind of acceptance of our ignorance regarding the nature of God, and of thus trusting in the word of God without trying to use our human faulty minds to understand what that's supposed to mean in a more real sense. Ibn Taymiyyah, being an adherent of this school essentially, takes basically the same positions. But in some respects, as is usually the case, he also diverges and goes even further than his fellow Hanbalis would sometimes. While he never states that God has a body or human attributes as such, and we should be very careful in keeping this in mind, he nonetheless rejects the incorporeal and non-spatial God of the Kalam scholars. Quote, Ibn Taymiyyah is decidedly empiricist. He claims that nothing incorporeal and non-spatial exists outside the mind. Something existing outside the mind must be accessible to the human senses, and God is no exception. While God cannot be seen in this world, he can be seen in dreams, and he will be seen in the hereafter. Ibn Taymiyyah himself says, quote, whatever cannot be sensed with the five senses is nothing but a non-existent. The generality of the Salaf and those who affirm God's attributes maintain that God can be witnessed, seen, and sensed. So Ibn Taymiyyah rejects metaphorical readings. He wants to claim that if the Quran states that God has a hand, then this is true, without having to explain it away as a metaphor or something. Quote, everything that his creatures are endowed with of perfected qualities, the Creator also possesses. Also, every fault which his creatures are declared above, the Creator is declared above them. So all positive qualities that humans have, God must have them too, otherwise that would imply an imperfection in God. This includes that, quote, Ibn Taymiyyah says that God is moving because, as he argues, a God who could not move on his own initiative would be inferior to creatures who can move. And similar arguments are used to argue that God indeed does have hands in a literal, albeit non-human sense. Ibn Taymiyyah is careful to point out that this doesn't mean that God has them in the way that humans do. He has them in a mode of his own. Quote, if one was to assert that God does not have a hand of the genus of created beings, that is in the sense of a limb, then this is true. If, however, he claims that God's hand is not additional to the seven attributes, he has grossly erred. This is very important. We should be careful not to claim that, in a very simplistic way, that Ibn Taymiyyah is simply an anthropomorphist, because he is very careful to point out that God is utterly different from creatures, as the Quran says, and that when he says that God has a hand or he sits on the throne, this does not mean that he has a hand in the way that humans do. Ibn Taymiyyah never claims outright that God has a body, but you could see why there could be confusion. But indeed, in many places, Ibn Taymiyyah appears to go even further by applying a view of God that seems spatial and even temporal. Again, he never outright says anything of the sort, but many of his descriptions seem to point in that direction. As explained by scholar John Hoover, Ibn Taymiyyah states that God is definitely over and above fawq, or thus outside of the universe. God, in fact, surrounds the universe and is described not as non-spatial, as the Kalam scholars would, but as enormous in size. Quote, it must be known that the upper and lower worlds relative to the Creator, exalted is He, is extremely small. God, exalted is He, surrounds all created things in a manner that befits His majesty. For the seven heavens and the earth in His hand are smaller than a chickpea in the hand of one of us. He also conceives of God as acting and interacting in a temporal sense. He hears prayers when they are uttered and not in some eternal moment outside of time. Thus, he seemed to hold the opinion that God exists within time and space, both as having a kind of form by stating that he is much larger than creation, and within time through acting and willing temporally. Understanding Ibn Taymiyyah's theology is a complex thing, of course. There are different scholars who still debate this issue to a very large degree. Some still want to call him basically an anthropomorphist or a corporealist in a very simplistic way. Other scholars argue that he definitely isn't one and that his views are significantly more nuanced, but I'll leave the discussion at that. In any case, you can see that he holds positions that were interpreted by some of his contemporaries as quite shocking. And it all goes back to that same fundamental idea of rejecting innovations in law and theology and instead only following the beliefs of the Salaf, whom he considered to have held the same ideas that he espoused. It all comes down to worship. Man was made to worship God, and he understands religion and theology from this perspective. The Muslim proclamation of faith, for example, La ilaha illallah, is not some ontological claim about the nature of reality, as many Sufis claimed. It is a simple command to worship God alone. And worship is done by following the law exactly as laid down in the Quran and in the practice of the prophets and the Salaf as-Saleh. Ibn Taymiyyah was a divisive and polarizing figure both during his lifetime and still today. He made a lot of enemies through his criticism of key Islamic institutions and his unique approach to law and theology. He did have a group of devoted followers, most notably Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, but in reality he wasn't all that successful in the immediate aftermath of his life. There were a group of people, mostly from the Hanbali school and a few others here and there, who selectively took inspiration from some of his writings, but he didn't have any massive impact on the Islamic intellectual world for the first few centuries. His popularity and influence really only started to pick up in the last few hundred years. It has inspired several revivalist movements within Islam. From the Wahhabi movement of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in the 18th century to the Salafis of the last 100 years or so, Ibn Taymiyyah has come to have an enormous influence today. His strict and fundamentalist view on Islamic practice has attracted a lot of people who have wanted to reform the religion. From the modernist movements in the late 19th century to the violent jihadist groups in the Middle East, they have all benefited from his unique approach. And that's the thing, we shouldn't simplistically connect him only to things like Salafism. His anti-tradition perspective of using ijtihad, or personal interpretation, rather than simply adhering to taqlid or imitation of legal precedents, and to find a more pure, original version of the religion, this has also influenced various progressive movements in the religion that we find today. So regardless of your perspective on his ideas, you can't deny that Ibn Taymiyyah is probably one of the most influential historical thinkers for the contemporary Islamic world. In the words of John Hoover, quote, "In addition to the Salafis, modernists and revivalists have drawn on Ibn Taymiyyah to present visions of Islam open to the contemporary world." The Pakistani modernist Fazlur Rahman writes approvingly of Ibn Taymiyyah's re-injection of divine wise purpose into mainstream Islamic thought, and he commends his ethical reformulation of Sufism for modern Muslim reform. The Qatari-based revivalist Yusuf al-Qaradawi invokes Ibn Taymiyyah's utilitarianism and political pragmatism to encourage Muslims to engage constructively in democratic and pluralist societies. He is a charismatic figure with a wide influence, and he is still polarizing to this very day. I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.